This is side two. We were talking when the tape ended about Floyd Reeves.
Yeah. Floyd Reeves had been at the University of Chicago for a long time, knew a lot about administration, and had worked very closely with the federal government. When John Hanna worked out the potential of how to do the point system and the discharge of people at the end of World War II, because he was working on personnel with the government part-time then, Floyd Reeves was the one who actually laid out the details of it. Floyd Reeves said earlier, when they decided to have a Tennessee Valley Authority, he was the one who did the administrative design and worked in the top administration of TVA for a long time. Anyway, he knew a lot about higher education and its administration, and John Hanna brought him here when we got the idea of general education, decided everybody needed a general education before this building was built for that purpose some years later. Mm-hmm. We started the wasn't called the University College.
Basic College.
Yeah. And it was Floyd Reeves who was the leader of that exercise in forming the Basic College. Because John Hanna was a visionary. We can talk more about him if you want. Mm-hmm. But he thought ahead. And he wanted to have television here when most universities thought, you teach face-to-face and it'll spoil it if you start doing it on television. Mm-hmm. And television will compete. If people watch television, they won't be going to school. And he was very negative, but he could see the possibility, which is why I got into television. And he could see a lot of other things in the future. He was, he thought very broadly and had, but he also brought in technical experienced people to help do the various things, and he had brought Floyd Reeves for that purpose. And then I backed up a little bit and said, yeah, because when I first came here in information services, my arrangement was an extension that if I would be allowed to take some courses toward a PhD, I'd come. Otherwise, I could stay in Delaware. Mm-hmm. The big advantage of coming here was not the greatness of within Michigan State College, which was still pretty great, but my Delaware friends kidding me, you'd leave the university and go to a college and things like that. But Michigan State College said, yeah, we have a rule here. If you're a full-time working faculty member, you can take one course each semester, which is not a lot of courses if they're averaging 3 credits each. Mm-hmm. And I did that all the years that I was talking about doing these other things. And then I would take one in the summer and sometimes do one ahead and back register and various things. But I took Floyd Reeves' course, which was excellent, and some others. And then the Kellogg Foundation was really concerned about Cooperative Extension Service, as it has been for many years. And they said, you're hiring people to be the directors of your extension services who don't know much about administration, and they don't know much about higher education and a lot of other things like that. And most of them did good work in a county someplace and got well known and got a little political clout. You made them extension director. We ought to have some kind of program to really prepare people to be directors of cooperative extension services in the various states. So they set up a program which was headquartered at the University of Wisconsin, and gave fellowships. And that fell very nicely into my long-range thinking, and Paul Miller, maybe with some reluctance, although he's also a great leader. He's down at Columbia, Missouri, at the University of Missouri now, where he's retired. He agreed, okay, we can get along without you for a year. I collected a lot of credits. Fortunately, in the CIC, or the Big Ten, as it's more generally known, you could change credits back and forth anywhere. So I went to the University of Wisconsin for one more year and finished that PhD. That's why we had the timing thing I mentioned earlier, because they transferred all my Michigan State credits there. And I became a full-time student for the first time in my life, which was a great experience. And when I finished my dissertation and had it bound in black, I cut out the K from Special K, which was a new cereal then, and pasted it on the cover, and gave one to the Kellogg people.
Did you know Russ Mauby then?
Yeah, well, Russ was doing some television as the on-the-air person in the kinescope recording days when he was in the Ag Econ department as a grad student before I came. And then when we started the live television, he did some emceeing for us. Then when I was associate director of Extension, we decided we're going to have an assistant director for agriculture and one for home economics and one for youth and one for marketing, which was a good thing which grew. and one for, which is now resource development. And Russ was the assistant director for youth and 4-H, which then was called the state 4-H leader. Mm-hmm. So we were close colleagues for several years. And in those days, Paul Miller was our outside man. He got the money, did the public relations, and George did personnel management and program development. And that lasted for several years until Paul Miller became the first provost. Different from later provosts, he went to the library and he looked up provost. One question, some people said provo and some people said provo and some people had other things. And he spent a week there. He was a scholar type. I remember that week because that was the week when all the calls that came for extension, especially since people had heard the director was leaving and they wanted to know what was going on, I had to take them for him because he was in line. He went to the Stacks. It was the old library, which is now a museum.
Uh-huh.
And as a scholar, he studied the literature on the administration of higher education, much of it from England, some of it from the United States, and found out what should a provost do. And as far as I know, he's the only provost who did that. At least the next couple, they thought they were anointed as a provost.
Oh.
When they were chosen, it was like somebody had touched their head with magic wine, and they all already know how to do it. Now, I'm not going to say any more about future provosts after that, but Paul was a very creative, vigorous provost who really related to the faculty, saw that as his main job. Main reason for having a provost, I think, was to look at the budget and see that the academic side has a role in it as well as the other parts of the university. But Paul Miller used to have meetings in his office with faculty members on some topic. And there usually were so many, we were sitting on the floor on the carpet discussing. And the evolution of the general education program, the changes in timing of things, the transition to the we were in quarters then, from the transition to the semesters came later, but it was discussed. One of his big projects was the changing of the name of home economics to human ecology, which was not an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. But, and it wasn't just a name change. They were concerned about ecology and the ecological movement long before some of the present popularity of the ecosystem came into effect. And ecosystem, managing families in a ecosystem was something that home economics was teaching already. Beatrice Pellucci, for whom one of the buildings named it, was a great leader in that field. And she produced a book on the ecological approaches to family life mm-hmm. and to home management, which had been called earlier. Anyway, Paul Miller was the administrator, creative administrator, people who convinced the other deans that it was all right to do that. And there were many other things that I really don't remember well enough to know. And he became a very dynamic and creative leader of that. Part of the thing that in those days, we had Continuing Education Service and Cooperative Extension Service, two different separate administrative units, Continuing Education headquartered in the Kellogg Center. And Woody Varner had started working towards some kind of a collaborative and merger thing. I think it was when he was the vice president. We set up every college had at least had one person who was sort of an assistant to the dean for continuing education. And so there were weekly meetings of people from every college in the Kellogg Center, and I was the representative from College of Agriculture and Natural Science, which was then just the College of Agriculture. Although natural resources, although we had the resource development type departments going. Anyway, but those were things where John Hanna could see ahead that you had to do more. And Paul Miller then became the one to really implement that. And so we changed responsibilities. We had a person in Grand Rapids who was in charge for that part of Michigan of continuing education and cooperative extension. Another one for the Upper Peninsula. And I think two others in other parts of the state. But you know, the Farm Bureau, that's them, and the Michigan Livestock Exchange, and the other groups who politically were sort of defending the tradition that they and I grew up in. You know, 4-H was for farmer kids. Mm-hmm. And they had not, we had had an office of extension in the city of Detroit for a long time. But having programs for urban people, for urban kids, and then by that time we had one member of our board of trustees who was a labor union representative, and we had to do, well, I think in the thing that was called extension was changing to a university-wide off-campus service thing to carry on educational and television in a way fit right into that, because we were, you know, we didn't have any boundaries and the relationship, and helping the other stations was from the very beginning, even before we went on the air, a part of the MSU responsibility in television. But when Paul Miller became the provost, I think the political pressure on President Hanna, who was very astute politically as well as creative educationally. I mean, in those days, he would go to the nominating conventions of both the Democratic and the Republican Party and make sure that both of them nominated a friend or alum of MSU as their candidate. And one of them always got elected, or two of them got elected. They might be for either party, but they were our friends. Mm-hmm. And he did a lot of other things of that sort. It became clear to him that we have to really get a straight line Aggie as our extension director. So he chose Pat Ralston, who was then head of the dairy department, a very fine gentleman. He became the director of it. And we did some shuffling around. And I became director of a thing called the Institute for Extension Personnel Development. Institute for Extension Personnel Development. I continued as, I guess I was associate director of Extension then, and personnel was my main concern, as it had been before, but then training new people. So in Ag Hall we had a one-person unit, and we gave master's degrees to Extension agents, dozens of them. I'm now recycling the paper, unfortunately, with a few tears, for the people who got their master's degrees during those years. Mm-hmm. There were lots of them. We had extension agents from coming in from the county to do a master's degree. And the goal was to have them really broaden their vision and see a lot of things that they hadn't thought about
before. So they did on-campus study?
They did on-campus study for 1 year. They could do their master's degree. And after they all had to do a thesis, so it took them a whole year, and sometimes a little more. And county extension personnel came from many other states as well. And that was a really exciting adventure for me. I learned a lot. Actually, you know, Michigan State has been teaching me and training me for 50 years, because it was February 1st of 1953. Mm-hmm. And I got to be 70 years old before February 1st of 2003. And so, about 5 years before, 7 years ago now, I really retired and I became Professor Emeritus. And if you're trying to do this chronologically, I'm skipping way ahead.
That's all right.
But
you said the university has been educating you.
Yeah, I have been learning from, and I have a great debt to the individuals and to the philosophy of it. And that brings me back to Hanna. You know, the other day someone was asking me in International Studies and Programs, how did Michigan State get involved? What was the driving force? And I said, number one, John A. Hanna. Number two, John A. Hanna. Number three, and there were some others. You know, Floyd Reeves was one of them. And Paul Miller, when he became provost, was very much interested in international studies and programs. And it was
that. How about Glenn Taggart?
Well, he was employed then. Glenn Taggart was working for the United States Department of Agriculture. They had a thing called OFAR, Office of Foreign Agricultural Relations. In World War II, they were very busy working in places like Turrialba in Costa Rica and some other agricultural research locations in Latin America, because, you know, we had a shortage of sugar, for instance, here during the war. We had to bring food from places, tropical food, mostly from these neighbors in Latin America, and the USDA was doing collaborative research with them in those years, focused mainly on the plantation crops where people like Dole could ship fruit to the mainland, or to the USA. And Glenn Taggart had worked with them over the years. He was a graduate of Utah State. He got his PhD at Wisconsin. And he was very much interested in international things. And when Ezra Taft Benson became the Secretary of Agriculture, by then Glenn had gotten high enough in their system that he was on the edge between professional appointees and political appointees. Well, John Hanna had seen him one day and said, you know, We have this rigorous dynamic rural sociology program at Michigan State in the sociology department. That year was still sociology and anthropology. And you'd fit in nicely. If you ever want to come, let me know. And he said, well, he was too busy. He didn't have time. But when somebody from Benson's office came to see Glenn Taggart and told him that we've decided to keep you, Glenn, he realized he had gotten at that point where further appointments were going to be political. And the gentleman left his office, and as he told it to me, as soon as the door was closed, he picked up the phone and called John Hanna. And he said, are you still interested in somebody with my kind of international experience? And John said, right away. So he came here, and he really taught and did research and extension in the sociology department for some time. Now, my memory's not that good. A year, maybe a little more. When then the dean of international programs and an office of international programs. Later, it got changed to international studies and programs, and I guess it's still ISP. And yes, and Glenn Taggart had a lot to do with the organizing. Both of them had connections with the Ford Foundation, and that's one thing, you know, an administrator of a public university has to spend a lot of time, obviously, not exactly fundraising with the politicians, but keeping the politicians informed that things are good and they should support the university, but also in the foundation world and in other places where it was legitimate to get financial support. And after his long, successful career here, people in Ford Foundation, Kellogg especially had great relationships with them, Rockefeller Foundation, those three particularly, they all knew John Hanna, and maybe not as much as me, but in general they worshipped him. So when he and Glenn Taggart came to see them about an international dimension at Michigan State, it would just become Michigan State University then. They were enthusiastic, and they provided funds which were very significant to this institution from then on. Now, you know, it was about 1959 when I was walking across the campus and with Glenn Taggart, who was a colleague in sociology.
In sociology.
Yeah. And I was then working in an extension with the extension personnel development. He was very excited about my students and the other things there. And Glenn said, President Hanna wants to see you. Do you mind if we take a shortcut and go by what's now the old...
Linton Hall?
Linton Hall. Mm-hmm. And he had an office up one long flight of stairs with a beautiful view of the circle. And I said, well, do we have to make an appointment or something like that? And he said, no, I think he's expecting us. Clever people. I said, what does he want to talk about? I said, let's wait till we get there. And I knew he'd been working in Nigeria, because at the last extension conference in which I was involved in planning the program and managing it, he'd just been back from a very exciting visit to Nigeria, to a site that he and Nnamdi Azikiwe, who had become the president of Nigeria, formerly Nnamdi Azikiwe was the governor general of the eastern region, but Azikiwe had found a site as far north and west as you could get in the eastern region of Nigeria, so as central as you could make it for that. And he wanted to start a university there, and he invited President Hanna, and they talked. And this is two of them. And I'm reflecting one characteristic of John Hanna, different from some other academic and administrative leaders, was that he himself, with his feet on the ground, went there. It's not like they cooked up a project someplace and wanted to send faculty over there to do something, mm-hmm. or they cooked up a new department someplace and wanted to have faculty do it. He listened a lot to the faculty. He knew the faculty very well. Every year we had a reception on this campus at the Student Union, same building, a little smaller then. He and Mrs. Hanna were the receiving line, and each person, faculty member and spouse, and from my very first year, when I walked through there, he'd call me by name, he'd say, George, how are you? How are things going with the television in the early years? And he knew what I was doing. When I started this Extension Personnel Development Institute that year, and I didn't say anything to him, I didn't know, he said, how's the training of extension agents going? Is the Extension Personnel Development Institute, I guess it was, going to survive? Everybody else on the line was the same way. And anyway, so John Hanna was very instrumental in a lot of things. and gave a on-hands leadership. But with his foundation connections, he was able to bring the idea to him. Now, while he was here, before the war ended, he had a faculty committee discussing international things, because what they were saying, and someplace in the International Center, if they haven't thrown it out, there were records of that committee, because they said, look, we have done a terrible thing, you know. We're educating students here at Michigan State College, and Michigan Agricultural College, not, and the University of Michigan, for that matter, to be citizens of Michigan, and good citizens, we're trying. But they don't know much about Indiana or Illinois, even. And the rest of the world is just a blank. And they are saying that because there were stories in the newspapers then. The Americans went to a certain island to land and take the island, but they didn't know there were coral reefs. Their maps didn't show that. They got up on the coral reef and the Japanese shot them all. And they were saying in this faculty meeting, somehow after the war, we have to do a better job of preparing our students to live in the world that they're going to have, which is international. They weren't using the word globalization, but they said international. Hanna understood that. He tied it to his Washington work, which was part-time. He was driving back and forth, flying back and forth with the Defense Department, because then the point system for getting people out of the military and the whole GI Bill, I think Floyd Reeves drafted the first draft of the GI Bill.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Hanna was very much involved with those kind of things. And so, you know, it wasn't just an accident that he tried to talk Glenn Taggart into coming here. And then if you set up a new deanship, the first things all the other deans will tell you is it's a big mistake, you shouldn't do it. We don't need it here. That's competition, you know.
Sounds like the tractor and the horse story.
Exactly. The other deans were not in favor of having a new dean, and I could say that same with communication arts. Mm-hmm. I was much involved personally in that because of my communication background, and I was very interested. But, you know, everybody else said, the English department could do that, or American thought and language could do that. Mm-hmm. And when others could, you don't need a college for communication arts. But back to my story of international things, because the Ford Foundation had given us money, you see, there was some clout available. So first President Hanover and of course Paul Miller also was involved. All three of them really were very much involved in that. So the deans and department chairs knew that they had this thing up there, a new dean, a provost, and a president, all who wanted us to become more international. But they had money, so they could say, okay, you got a professor who's teaching three courses. We'll buy out his time for one-third of that to do international research or international travel or international something. And they could say to the professor, you know, if you go to Okinawa, one of our earlier projects, you know, first of all, we say to the dean, we'll of course, absorb his whole salary while he's gone. It'll save you all of that money. And we will pay him his salary plus an overseas incentive allowance or something like that, plus we'll pay all the costs of his travel back and forth. If he wants to take his family, we'll do that, and so on. They usually had contracts for that, contracts with ICA and MSA before that. ICA later became AID, our present thing that happened in the John Kennedy era, and AID is still the name. And some contracts, like our work in Colombia, was funded by Kellogg Foundation, our good friends here. But we started doing technical assistance projects here and there, not because the professors and I think the administration would rather have them go to do research in their field, wherever it was in that place, but nobody would pay for that. So we said, okay, you can go to country X, for instance, if you're an entomologist, and teach and give them, help them set up their department of entomology. That's what you're being paid. While you're there, expand your insect collection. Because when you come back here, we want you to be able to teach not only about the insects of USA, but maybe the insects of Africa too, or the insects of South Asia, or wherever you're going. And the same was true in soils. We have a soils department here. People teaching that, we want you to go to a place where there's volcanic soils. Not just to teach what you teach here, you better learn about volcanic soils while they're there, bring some soil samples back, and so on. Same with the social sciences. You know, you're going to a Hindu culture, you better learn something about Hindu culture while you're there. And if you're going to come back, And again, John Eustein was interested in cross-cultural things before that, but he and his wife Ruth Eustein, who's also a scholar, they studied Hindu culture. They learned a lot about it. And we did have a project, a medical project in Madras an engineering, small engineering project also, but we were able to, we, the university, were able to facilitate people like John Useem doing his work there, and he wrote a book called Western Educated Man in India, which has become a classic in terms of what happens to people when they get a Western education, they go back to their own culture and try to survive. Some of these names are popping up in my mind. You can see I've got no papers. It's not.
No, no.
I'm leaving out some. That's great. And I'm just giving you the ones that come to mind. Mm-hmm. But the deliberate effort of the university was to get as many of our faculty to have an experience abroad in a different kind of place than Michigan or different than the USA and learn enough so when they came back and taught, they could build that into their curriculum, their past classroom material. And let me see if I can put some year numbers on these. From before 1959, maybe 1958, for the next two decades, that was central and a major thing. Because it was late in 1959 when I had this meeting I started telling you about before with President Hanna and Glenn Taggart in Hanna's office. And he said, George, how would you like to go to Nigeria? And I said, why would I go to Nigeria? He said, well, we're having some administrative problems there. We've sent out a team of six people. None of them had, they didn't realize how naive and innocent we were. And I said, you know, President Hanna was very much involved in President Harry Truman's Point Four speech. I don't know, there'd be no reason for you to remember that, but when he, second inaugural address, the fourth point was the, Point Four was the whole internet foreign aid to implement the Marshall Plan and to do these other things. Point Four was saying, we had, the Marshall Plan had been going and a great success in Europe. And Point Four was saying, look, we have the technology to produce food. The world has a lot of starving places. We should send our experts, because we can solve the world's hunger problem probably in a decade. We promise it sounds a lot like our present administration. I mean, they were impossible things. We, including myself, were definitely naive and arrogant. We thought we knew. And that what I learned personally and others since and in various ways was that we were both naive and arrogant because we not only didn't know the answers, we didn't know the questions. And plenty of examples of that. I'll give you just one. At a certain point we got started in Pakistan. It was East and West Pakistan then. Ford Foundation was going to pay the bill. They came to MSU to organize it. We already had our Office of International international programs going, and we assembled a small team which had Larry Boger, who was head of the Department of Agricultural Economics, later became Dean of the College of Agriculture, and Floyd Reeves, and one or two others on it. They went to both East and West Pakistan, and they studied the situation, and we learned an awful lot because they were instrumental with Ford and the governments of those two branches of then one Pakistan in the selection of who the leadership would be. And they selected a person for the West at Peshawar, where our joint venture was, with a training program for what it would be like for county extension agents here. It was Village Aid, it was called. It was training of village. It was a Village Aid Academy. And Roger Offsell was a good public servant who followed the rules and didn't make anybody angry, and the government liked him, and he became the director of it. Over in the East Pakistan, at a place called Kamila, they had another one of these village aid schools, and our committee, and heavily influenced by Floyd Reeves probably, ran it up against this guy called Dr. Hamid Khan. And he'd been in the Indian Civil Service, and he'd resigned because he didn't like it. I whisper when I say that. Resigning from the Indian Civil Service in those days was a catastrophe. Your own family would be really annoyed at you because they had paid money to get you an education, you passed a lot of exams, you had become an elite, whatever, and you were giving that up. But Dr. Hamid had worked as a civil servant in one district in West Bengal, and he didn't think the government was doing the right thing for the people. And he understood village life. He was a student of the Quran as well as his English was better than mine, which is not saying too much, but and he thought that we're not paying enough attention to the really hungry and to the rural people and so on. And he was one of several candidates to be the director of that East Pakistan center at Comilla. And the Americans really liked him, and I think the Pakistanis were not too happy. But since our team had gone along with Roger Afzal in the West, they said, okay, we'll go along with Dr. Hamid in the East. And he became the director of that institute. And there's plenty of documented history since then on rural development and international development that came from him. In the first year, he wouldn't let us, they hired a staff of both groups did, hired staff that was going to work with him. They sent them both to Michigan State for a year. Since I was directing the Institute for Extension Personnel Development, I was involved in their training program here. I'll give you one little incident for that. I took a group with Dr. Hamid and others up to Marquette because I wanted them to see Michigan along the way. We had a speaker on the bus and we were having lecture and discussion all the way up and all the way back. The bridge was new then. We got to Marquette, and I was chatting with Dr. Hamid in the lobby of the hotel when the manager came to see us, and he was furious. One of our participants was ruining his plumbing. Well, we raced up to his room on the second or third floor, I don't know what it was,